This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara coming to you from Gadigal land. This Thursday, the Medibank hackers claim they've dumped all remaining stolen customer data on the dark web. Jubilation and bleary eyes from Doha to Australia with the Socceroos through to the knockout stage of the World Cup. And on World AIDS Day, the reflections of one of the first Australians to test positive to HIV and survive.
The first thing I did when I was put into my bed on the ward was to get the nurse to draw the curtains. I think I was in massive denial and I just didn't want to admit that, yeah, that was me.
The cyber hacking crisis at Medibank has entered a new uncertain phase, with the criminal hackers now saying they've released all the stolen files in their possession. The suspected Russian hackers have described the latest release as case closed. But Medibank is sceptical and believes more private customer data will be released in the coming days and weeks. Our senior business correspondent Peter Ryan is covering the cyber attack, and we spoke earlier. Peter, how significant is this latest data release? Is this everything now?
Sally, Medibank remains cautious. They're reluctant to even consider that this might be the beginning of the end. The private insurer issued a statement this morning saying they were aware the data had been released on the dark web, but wary about reports that this is a signal of case closed, to quote the hackers, saying the raw data analysed so far is incomplete and hard to understand. But they're analysing the files released overnight, confirming there were 6 zipped files in a folder called Full, containing stolen data. Chief Executive David Koska says the customer data just released has not been joined with customer names or contact details, and so far not enough to enable identity or financial fraud. But he says, unfortunately, this most likely won't be the end, and he's expecting more data will be dumped on the dark web in the coming days and weeks.
So, Peter, what do we draw from this comment from the hackers saying the case is closed? What does it mean?
Well, Sally, this is the biggest data dump to date rather than the drip feeds we've had in the past. It could mean that Medibank's refusal to pay the $15 million ransom being demanded is working and that the hackers are simply done with it, realising they won't be paid. It could mean the criminals won't be posting any more data, hoping to drop off the scrutiny of law enforcement agencies and maybe then move on to other targets. But regardless, with the data of potentially 9.7 million current and former Medibank customers out there, people will have to be vigilant for years, even decades, given that the data could be sold to other criminal groups on the dark web, looking to piece together enough information to hijack identities and to ultimately get access to bank accounts or even superannuation funds.
Peter, what are the chances that Medibank could be hit with class actions?
Well, there's a number of legal action underway at the moment, and the latest is from the law firm Maurice Blackburn. It's lodged a complaint with the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, which has the power to order compensation to Medibank customers. They're claiming that Medibank failed in its duties to protect personal information. This could mean hefty fines that could run into the tens of millions of dollars if customers need to be compensated. Medibank's already putting aside $40 million to deal with helping customers, but that could easily get higher. And meanwhile, the insurance regulator APRA says it's intensifying its supervision of Medibank and will consider further regulatory action. And that could include not just compensation, but what it calls consequence management, which could see generous bonuses to top Medibank executives ultimately clawed back.
Peter, the Australian Federal Police a few weeks ago suggested that the hackers were based in Russia. Has there been any headway in getting Russian authorities to help track them down?
Well, there was an interesting briefing from the Russian Foreign Ministry overnight where a spokeswoman said Russia would assist Australia if formally approached. But Russia's accused Australia of not using proper diplomatic channels to investigate the origins of the Medibank attack, which the Federal Police have previously blamed on Russian-based cyber criminals. The spokeswoman said Australia could have the opportunity to make proper contact with Russian cyber specialists rather rather than engaging in what she called political battles.
That's Peter Ryan there. To South Australia now, and communities in South Australia's Riverland have almost finished preparing for the floodwaters that are heading their way. Most towns have built temporary levees to keep homes and businesses dry, but the problem now is keeping vital electricity infrastructure safe. As Angus Randall reports, businesses say the real damage could be from lost income if the power goes out.
The town of Renmark has had weeks to prepare for the floodwaters coming down the Murray from Victoria and New South Wales. Peter Hunter is the mayor of Renmark Paringa Council.
Very well prepared in terms of the banks surrounding Renmark. At the moment, they're doing daily checks to make sure we don't get some seepage or breaks in those banks.
It's one of the more low-lying towns in South Australia's Riverland, and Renmark has had a brief reprieve. The flood peak was expected within days, but has now been delayed until December 14. Peter Hunter is confident Renmark's more than 5,000 residents will stay dry.
Well, with any luck, they won't need to see much difference at all, apart from being able to walk down and have a look at a river in flood. Our banks are built to 250 gig flows at the border, and the most likely predictions are around 175 and then 185, so there's a fair buffer there.
A bigger worry for those in the town is electricity. Earlier this week, SA Power Networks sent text messages to most residents warning of possible outages to protect energy infrastructure.
The issue has got people a little bit anxious, I suppose, in the way it was delivered. So for us at the moment, yes, be aware, it's not impossible. Some power could go out in some locations, but SA Power Networks assures me that they'll contact people individually wherever they can, and they'll leave them on as much as they can. So it's certainly not a fear that all of Renmark's going out tomorrow.
Teresa Scheuer owns Murray Marine Centre in Renmark. She sells generators, so her business will stay open even if the power goes out. But she wants more information about if and when electricity will be cut off.
The gossip, the hard thing is working out fact and gossip. And at the moment, the gossip is that they'll start turning off power. I don't understand what's actually going to happen yet, and that's the unfortunate side, because gossip can get quite destructive, and also media pressure on it can get destructive. At the moment, Renmark's a great town to visit to actually see what's happening with the water, and it's just fascinating to see all this water, whereas most people won't come near Renmark because of the fear that they'll be flooded.
Every summer, the Riverland is filled with tourists keen to spend their holiday on the river. Most of those have cancelled this year. There has been a small bump in day trippers coming to see the swollen river, but it's not quite the same. Jenny Richards owns Cinnamon Grove Cafe in Renmark.
People that want to come and have a squizzy and look at what's happening, you know, the ones from the Barossa and from Adelaide and whatever want to come and have a look, which they're doing. That gets you a coffee and a lunch.
She's not bought a generator for backup power, so if the electricity goes out, she'll be forced to shut up shop.
I don't want to panic, but power will be the big thing. I feel perfectly safe that my business is safe from being flooded and my home, but power is a big thing. Power goes out, well, doors are closed.
SA Power Networks says up to 1,950 properties across the Riverland could be switched off by the end of the week.
That's Angus Randall. Right across Australia, you're listening to The World Today. Today marks World AIDS Day. In Australia, around 30,000 people are living with HIV. Activists and researchers are backing a plan to eliminate HIV transmission in Australia by 2025. You're about to hear from one of the first Australians to test positive to HIV in the 1980s and survive. Life-saving medication has dramatically improved survival and quality of life for many. Peter Schlosser has not only lived with AIDS, but four bouts of cancer. The 59-year-old first tested positive to HIV in January 1985. Peter still remembers receiving the news from his doctor.
It happened really quickly, and I just looked at the top of the page and said HIV positive. And he just looked at me and said, "Peter, you're about to turn 22. You're not going to have a 25th birthday." That was it. So nobody spoke about it, but people just started to vanish.
Peter, can you tell me about being in the AIDS ward at St Vincent's Hospital? What was that like for you?
It was absolutely terrifying for me. When I was wheeled in, everyone was in masks and goggles and thick gloves, and I just saw mostly young men, these emaciated yet bloated-bellied, ravaged young men on ventilators, on drips. The first thing I did when I was put into my bed on the ward was to get the nurse to draw the curtains. And the thing that I think was most terrifying about it was, this is my future. I'm already here.
Were some of the young men in that ward not being visited by their families?
I'm going to try really hard not to cry. I was actually there when a family came to visit their son. They'd come to disown and abandon, and that broke my heart, and I can't imagine how it felt for this young guy to know that you were being abandoned by the people that you grew up with, that raised you, that supposedly loved you. That was one of the hardest things to see people rejected by their loved ones. To me, it was the day that I would lose my family. And the one that I was scared of most was my dad. Having said that, we ended up becoming really good friends. He ended up finding out that the Pufta had most in common with him, because I like to create and make things. My dad was a builder and a plumber, and I'm so glad that he changed. To change that late in life as well was amazing. And on his deathbed, he apologised and he said, "You're just like us." And I said, "Yeah, Dad, I'm just like you." And he said, "You know I'm proud of you. You know I love you." And then the one that really hit me was, "You're my mate." That was just the best thing he could ever, the best gift I could ever have got. And then he died the next day.
Some of the beds that were near your bed, were they changing over with patients while you were there, Peter?
They were in 1994, right near the peak of HIV deaths. I was admitted to hospital for a period of 2 weeks. I mean, I didn't know how long I was going to be in hospital, but it was 2 weeks. And at the end of that 2 weeks, I was the only one from my ward that went home at the end of that 2 weeks. I'd watched all of the beds empty on my ward twice. So I watched six people die. And by the time I left, it was just a whole new group of people on that ward that I didn't know.
What do you think has stayed with you from those experiences on the ward?
That resilience, that will to make the best of right now. Humour, even as dark as it was, and it was viciously dark, it was that. Even if it was false bravado, it was still bravado. I mean, there was laughter on the ward. There was a sense of guilt as well. So, and today I still sometimes catch myself feeling, I never understood the term survivor's guilt until I felt it. Why did they not make it, and why am I still here?
What do you do with those feelings of survivor's guilt?
What's replaced that sense of guilt is this feeling of how fortunate I am, how lucky I am. And that's what I try to cling to. I mean, I lose my grip sometimes. You know, I could be having the most beautiful day and I'll just start to cry. It's the wishing that the people that you loved aren't here to enjoy that with you. And then, you know, how fortunate am I?
That's Peter Schlosser there, who was diagnosed with HIV in 1985, reflecting on his experiences for World AIDS Day. And if this story has raised any issues for you, you can find more information at positivelife.org.au. Australia has had another stunning victory at the World Cup in Doha, this time against world number 10, Denmark. For just the second time in history, the Socceroos now move into the round of 16. There have been scenes of jubilation from Qatar to Australia, but coach Graham Arnold is telling his team to stay focused on the task ahead, with Australia to face Argentina. While the odds will once again be stacked against the Socceroos, this cup has proven that anything is possible. Sarah Sedgie reports.
From group underdogs to heroes, In Melbourne's Federation Square, fans gathered in the early morning to see the Socceroos make history. Their first back-to-back World Cup victories, and for just the second time ever, they'll progress to the knockout stage of the tournament, a feat only achieved by the Golden Generation of 2006. For much of the first half, Denmark dominated, but after half-time came a thrilling counter-attack by Matthew Lecky, and he was unstoppable.
It's on for Matthew Lecky. Matthew Lecky cuts back inside, one way, then the other! And he scores for Australia! Matthew Lecky!
After the game, he reflected with the SBS commentators on his first World Cup goal that'll no doubt go down in history.
I think by the celebration you see how much emotion there was. Just so proud, you know, we've worked so hard.
Like many Australians, former Socceroo Bruce Duté was up early watching.
Oh, it's a huge achievement. They would be pumped.
Can you reflect on that incredible goal by Matt Lecky?
It was brilliant. And it was a game where we had hardly any possession. Denmark dominated large parts of that game. So it would have been easy for Riley not to have the composure to find Matt Lecky. He does that successfully. And Lecky has the composure to not make any rash decisions, you know, try to go one way, defender went with him, try to go the other way, defender went with him. So he did a bit of a chopping and turning to try create a bit of space, and he did that successfully, and the finish was brilliant on his least favourite foot.
Australia were the group underdogs, yet delivered two incredible wins. What do you think is working for them?
I think it's the togetherness of that group, and Arnie's always been big on that. Of course, they're not playing at the biggest clubs in the world like a lot of the other players at the World Cup. So, you know, what's the competitive advantage? What can it be? You know, harness the Aussie spirit, that togetherness, that mateship.
After Australia's victory over Tunisia a few days ago, coach Graham Arnold was quick to advise the team to stay focused. That advice paid off, so he's reiterating the message.
Yeah, look, just so proud of the effort by the boys, and made a lot of belief, a lot of hard work. And, you know, these boys come in with a great mindset. We've been working on this for four and a half years, about the belief of the energy and the focus. As I said to the boys, that's why we won after a great win against Tunisia. No celebrations, no emotion, sleep, no social media.
Advice midfielder Jackson Irvine is heeding, as he told ABC News Channel.
I'll be going straight down to start my recovery and you know, watch the second half of these games going on. Yeah, literally, just freeze my balls off for a bit. That's the way it's... I forgot I'm live as well. Yeah, there'll be a time to enjoy it when at the end of the tournament, but for now, focus on the next one.
Australia next meets Argentina at the weekend, and it'll be tough competition. But anything is possible. And former Socceroo Bruce Duté says that's what makes the game so thrilling.
Football, one of the beauties of it is that it's not always the best team on paper that wins. And, you know, if they beat Argentina, then be prepared for the discussions about winning the World Cup. Dare to dream.
Dare to dream indeed. That's former Socceroo Bruce Duté ending that report from Sarah Sedgi. After a 25-year veto, the federal parliament is set to give the ACT and the Northern Territory the ability to set their own rules on euthanasia. Territory senators say it's about time, but what does the change mean for Territorians? Political reporter Claudia Long explains.
Private Senators' Bills, Order of the Day number 25.
ACT Independent Senator David Pocock is hoping the Senate can work particularly efficiently today.
Debate will start again at 5:30 on the Territory rights bill.
He's hoping to see big changes for the ACT and Northern Territory get the final seal of approval from the Parliament tonight.
This is historic, finally giving the ACT and the Northern Territory, returning our democratic right to debate and legislate on these important issues.
The bill the Senate will be considering later today will overturn a decades-long veto on the Territory's making rules about euthanasia. It stretches back to the turn of the millennium, when in the late 90s, the Northern Territory introduced the world's first legal euthanasia program.
Opponents of voluntary euthanasia say today's announcement of a third death under the Northern Territory law is more about politics than compassion for the dying.
That was something that deeply unsettled then-government MP Kevin Andrews, who in 1997 introduced a bill to veto the Territory's making those sorts of rules.
First, the bill states that the legislative assemblies have no power to make laws which permit or have the effect of permitting the form of intentional killing of another called euthanasia, which includes mercy killing.
But not everyone in Canberra was on his side. A main voice of opposition, a newly elected Labor backbencher, Anthony Albanese.
This issue is an issue of human dignity, and we'll be voting against Kevin Andrews' bill.
But despite some opposition from the Labor benches, Mr Andrews' changes were successful. The Parliament has come close to overturning them once before, in 2018, when attempts to reinstate territory rights were defeated by 2 votes. ACT Chief Minister Andrew Barr had been on the job for 4 years when that happened. Still the head of the ACT government, he's more than ready for change.
I'm hopeful that the bill will pass tonight and that we'll resolve 25 years of injustice.
Since the ban was imposed decades ago, all of the states have set up their own assisted dying laws. Even when the Territory Rights Bill passes, the ACT and the NT won't automatically start implementing euthanasia programs. They'll still need to legislate to set up their own assisted dying options. Andrew Barr says the ACT government will be consulting with the local community before putting a plan forward.
So we will use the Christmas and New Year period to refine and finalise our public consultation process. The timeframe then for a government-sponsored voluntary assisted dying bill into the ACT Assembly would be the second half of 2023.
And he's calling on federal senators to reject amendments from the coalition this afternoon, which the opposition argues will protect young people from accessing assisted dying.
Any legislation that's introduced by the ACT government into the Territory Parliament will be for adults. There's no suggestion that legislation in the territories would differ from the legislation in the 6 states.
Senator David Pocock won't be supporting the amendment and is calling on other senators to do the same.
Should the territories legislate voluntary assisted dying schemes, it would prohibit a huge number of people from accessing those.
That's Senator David Pocock ending that report from Claudia Long. Finally today, Fijians head to the polls in 2 weeks' time, with former coup leaders, military men and long-time politicians all running for the top job. And in a bid to win over younger voters, many candidates have taken to dancing and performing on the video platform TikTok. Jordan Fennell reports.
Someone asked me the other day, do you ever lift, bro?
It's a new side of a familiar face. Former Fijian Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka is a 74-year-old veteran of the Pacific Nations politics, having instigated a military coup in the 1980s. Now, in a bid to win over voters again, he talks to camera while wiping the sweat off his face after finishing a workout.
And I said, yes, I used to, but now I'm more interested in lifting the standard of this country.
Since Rambuka joined TikTok a week ago, his videos have been watched more than 500,000 times. His most popular video is a skit of him shopping for fabric in a store as an Indo-Fijian shop assistant approaches him with a question.
If me and people like me vote for you now, will we be okay?
In 1987, Rambuka led an ethno-nationalistic coup and overthrew the then Indo-Fijian-dominated government, leading to an exodus of non-Indigenous Fijians from the country. Pacific Digital researcher Jope Terai says Rambuka's new TikTok presence is about putting that past behind him.
And so he's responding to that by seeking to assure those that were born within the millennium that we're in now that they are safe and that they are secure.
With some, the approach seems to be working. 19-year-old Indo-Fijian University student Alshaker Ashad Ali is a first-time voter.
You can see videos at the comfort of your house and then you can decide who is the best alternative for you to vote for.
The youth vote is a key target for Fijian politicians, with people under the age of 35 making up more than 60% of the population. Researcher Jope Terai says turnout is the key hurdle.
We have to speak their language.
And on TikTok, that language is dance. Another video shows Fiji's Labour Party leader, Mahendra Chaudhry, in an office surrounded by a group of dancers.
I'd like to take my message to the youth. They have a lot of problems here which need to be attended to, so we need to reach out to them.
A week after his opponents joined the platform, the incumbent Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, signed up too, albeit with a different approach.
I'm not here to dance. Leadership is serious business.
But it's not clear that particular tactic will resonate. Jope Terai says for a political message to be successful on TikTok, it has to be tailored to the site.
The platform is about entertainment. If you don't agree with me, at least you can give me the space to listen to me for a few seconds. If you're not going to vote for me, at least you can sort of enjoy this moment with me.
Fiji's general election will be held on the 14th of December.
That's Jordan Fennell reporting. And The World Today approached Mr. Bainimarama and Mr. Rambuka for comment. That's all from The World Today team for this Thursday. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Integrity in politics has been in the spotlight, the former Prime Minister Scott Morrison being censured by the Parliament over his secret ministries. In the same week, a National Anti-Corruption Commission has passed. Today, Radio Breakfast host Patricia Karvelas on how the new body could go some way to restore confidence in our political system. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.